LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
President Kennedy was shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She cried, "Oh no." The motorcade sped on. A photographer said he saw blood on the president's head. It was believed two shots were fired.
President Kennedy has been shot in Dallas, Texas. He was shot while he was touring town with Governor Connally in the famous bubble car. The bubble was down. Three shots rang out, and the president slumped forward, and Governor Connally remained seated upright. So far, the latest word is that they are still alive. Mrs. Kennedy, as soon as the president slumped forward, she grabbed him, she cradled him in her arms, and she said, "Oh no," and tried to hold up his head. Then the car was quickly taken out of line and sped to the hospital. The president and the governor were rushed to Parkland Hospital near Dallas, the Dallas trademark, where Mr. Kennedy was to have made a speech.
That the president has died. However, we must emphasize that this report has so far been unconfirmed.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. These details about the same as previously. President Kennedy shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh no," the motorcade sped on. United Press says that the wounds for President Kennedy perhaps could be fatal.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Farsight Institute Director Courtney Brown, who joins us once again to discuss their latest remote viewing project, the JFK assassination. While part one probed the identity of the shooters, part two now examines who or what was behind the plot and their possible motivation. Please note that while the date of the assassination during the interview is referred to as 1993, it is of course meant to be 1963. The assassination of US President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, remains one of the most controversial events in world history. The official story, that Kennedy was killed by a lone gunman acting alone, has been hotly disputed almost from the start. Indeed, along with the Apollo moon missions and the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the JFK assassination has been the popular subject of numerous so-called conspiracy theories, as everyone from serious researchers to outright cranks formulate their own version of the fateful day's events. Having previously used their skills to probe deeper into mysteries such as the existence of extraterrestrial life, the legendary island of Atlantis, and the aforementioned 9/11 attacks, Farsight's remote viewers now turn their attention to JFK's violent demise. Even a cursory review of that deadly day in Dallas reveals an official narrative shot through with gaping holes. Reaching beyond the bounds of time and space, the remote viewing data reveals chilling new details of a murder that lives on in infamy. Hello and welcome, Courtney, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greg, it is a great pleasure to be here. You're a great host, and I really love being here with you.
Wasn't that long ago since you were here, Courtney, and the reason being, today we're going to be discussing the latest Farsight remote viewing project, which is the JFK assassination. A few weeks ago, you and I discussed part one, the shooters. Today we're going to be talking about part two, the organizers. If people want to know about the Farsight Institute, they can go to farsight.org. That address will be linked up on the interview page. You'll be talking about that at the end of the interview. Also, personal information about who you are and about Farsight can be found
among the many interviews that you and I have previously done. Before we dive into this information about part two of the new project, just for people who don't know, give them a quick 101 on what remote viewing actually is.
Sure. It's a mental procedure. In the old days, people might have called it psychic, but we don't do that anymore. It's a mental procedure that was developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes. And that procedure is very highly structured. We understand how it works now. The Farsight Institute, which, as Greg mentioned, was farsight.org. That's like seeing far, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T.org, because we're a nonprofit, is the largest civilian organization venue where these large public projects, actually we're the only venue where these large public projects using remote viewing, as it is done using methods that are derived from the U.S. military methodologies, are done and shown publicly. We are civilian. We've developed new procedures ourselves. They are derivative of the military procedures, but there's been a lot of advancement. So we're not stuck with the old military ways of doing things. We have, things have evolved greatly, and instructional material for how this is done is all available for free on our website, has always been, and under the you can see it under the SRV section of the instructional section of the website. So it's a means of transferring perceptual information across time and space in a very highly structured manner, and the accuracy of it is extraordinary. In the old days, we used to do what the military did, was to do the remote viewing on pieces of paper and pen. But we don't do that anymore. We do it all recorded live on video. And so it's much more persuasive when you actually see the remote viewing done, when the remote viewer is being recorded live under totally blind conditions. They're not told anything about what they're supposed to be perceiving. And so the audience that's watching it on video is spellbound watching it, and with the application done with these really interesting targets, which are the things they're supposed to be perceiving, we get to answer mysteries that have been around for a very long time. In 2016, by the way, we're going to be focusing on some science projects that we're going to be returning to some science projects that we did some years back with the new video technology, this time exploring the nature of time and physical reality. But we've been so far doing mostly, for the last couple of years, mysteries projects, which is basically using remote viewing to unravel major mysteries in the world, including like how the Great Pyramid of Giza was constructed, the backstory behind 9/11 events, some extraterrestrial UFO type stuff, and also now the JFK assassinations. And we have another one coming out in January, which I will be announcing in early January. So, you know, but after that, we're going to be dealing with science projects, which is going to be equally fascinating, but a little different in orientation.
Okay, so as mentioned, the latest project, the JFK assassination, referring, of course, to late U.S. President John F. Kennedy. Give us a quick info blast on part one before we get
into part one. Part one was on the shooters. We went in with targets that were just very... Targets are the descriptions of what the remote viewers are supposed to perceive. They're not told this. They're not told anything. They're just told in a non-leading email, there is a target, describe it, that's the end. And then they use these procedures and come out with all the details of what that thing is. Now, we understand the science now of how it actually is done. We didn't in the past. We do now. We published about that, and we now use it. So this is not something that's taught in schools yet. So if you say, well, it can't be true because I wasn't taught about it in my physics class, well, you weren't taught about anything in your physics classes if you go back in time far enough. I mean, everything is always new. And if you jump 50 years into the future, everything you're taught in physics class is going to be obsolete. You're going to have a whole new physics coming out. So, you know, the basic paradigms of quantum mechanics and relativistic physics are over 100 years old. There have been advances in the details. We do quantum computing and stuff like that. But there's been no fundamental changes in the paradigms for over 100 years. that tells you by itself that a revolution is coming. So anyway, what we actually did was a revolution in thought is coming. So the first part was about the shooters, where this was the target. And again, the viewers were not told this target. They were just told that there is a target, remote view it. But after all the remote viewing was done, everything recorded live on video and all locked up and sealed and everything, this is what the remote viewers were told to have perceived. The viewer will remote view the assassination of John F. Kennedy as it occurred in Dealey Plaza in Dallas on Friday, November 22nd, 1993. The viewer will perceive the assassination itself in all of its complexity, as well as any preparatory activity immediately prior to the assassination that may be related to the assassination. Okay, so that was part one, the shooters. Now, that documentary went on for 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's a remote viewing documentary, meaning using remote viewing to document what happened. So that basically discussed in detail the operations, where there were essentially two teams of three people each who were the shooters. And one was the actual person who held the rifle. The other was an assistant. And then there was an overseer that stood back a little bit. But there were two of those teams and they were strategically placed. From our data, we have no evidence at all implicating Lee Harvey Oswald in the actual shooting event. The data do suggest that he was set up, classic Patsy type of a thing, because that would have been necessary in such an operation. And the people who actually did the shooting, and there were other support personnel around Dealey Plaza as well, they were expert marksmen. They were a highly skilled team, and they were, without question, governmentally organized. So it was an inside job. That's what that part one comes about. And so I am not saying that remote viewing data prove this. I'm just saying learn about remote viewing, see all of our projects so you can see the quality of the work, understand the nature of the phenomenon, see the data for yourself, and then make your own decision. Remote viewing cannot be used to prove anything because nothing can be done to prove anything. Because even in a court of law, you can't say you prove something. What you do is you build a case for something based on all available evidence. And then a jury and a judge decides one way or the other whether they think somebody's guilty or not. So these data would not even be accepted in a court of law because mainstream science hasn't yet accepted the way in which the data were collected. But for those people who know about the remote viewing phenomenon, who are understanding of how it's done and what it can achieve, this is where you can actually see it done, and it's extremely persuasive when you see these data come in under totally blind conditions, and they are describing exactly in really clear detail the person going down the street in the car with his wife, the gunshots, tracing the bullets, the whole story, everything you know about the real situation from the Zapruder film, from the government story, all of that is recreated, but you also get the backstory. Now, the second part, we couldn't fit any more in a DVD. These are available, by the way, as DVDs and videos on demand through Vimeo. And the second part is called The Organizers. So the organizers are... This is the target. I'll read you the target. The viewer will remote view the highest level organizational and planning meeting that orchestrated the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The viewer will perceive the individuals involved in the meeting, the thoughts and emotions of those individuals, and the hierarchical structure around which those involved in the assassination are organized. So the first part, the shooters, demonstrated that it was a very highly organized assassination done with a very significant number of highly trained people. The second one, who organized the whole thing? Who ordered it? So on. So this is where it was clearly portrayed as far as these remote viewing data are concerned. Again, I'm not saying proving anything. What I'm saying is, according to these remote viewing data, and for those who know about remote viewing and the quality of the work that these remote viewers can do and the nature of our experiments, the controls that are placed, I believe that these data are extremely persuasive. And for those who know about it, this is where they can get what really happened. So it does appear from the perspective of these remote viewing data that this was classically an inside job. People within the government had Kennedy shot.
Okay, just briefly, Courtney, then, if the two remote viewers involved in these sessions, Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier, who you've worked with many times, how did the session sequence work? Because if in part one you're doing the shooters, part two the organizers, was it all, from their perspective, was it all basically one long session?
No. In fact, this project, it was called Mysteries Number 14, mm-hmm. and it had four targets. And the targets, two of the targets related to Kennedy and two of the targets related to something completely different. But targets one and two of Project 14 were not done in sequential order. So target one was involving the shooters, as I described you before. Target two was the organizers. That was actually the last target that they did for the entire series. So they did the first one, then they went off and did something completely different for like 2 months. And then they came back to this one and they did the organizers. So it was not one session at all. In fact, it was a number of sessions. They sometimes do a video session and don't get it all in, and they run out of, they run out of time, they're exhausted, whatever. And, they have to go back and finish it. So, if you consider all of the video for the shooters, that was done, finished, wrapped, and then the organizers was done, say, 2 months later in a completely separate thing that they had no idea was even connected to that. So the first time, in the shooters, they clearly got John Kennedy driving in Daley Plaza in the car and the gunshots and everything. In the second one, they were supposed to get a meeting, and that's exactly what they got. They got this meeting, and the meeting was organizing an assassination. Firewalls were being established. People were being told what to do. They clearly described the nature of the people that were involved in the meeting. Fascinating stuff. But there was no shooting in the meeting. And, Greg, I've mentioned this a number of times to you on your show, and I don't know if I know you have a worldwide audience, but I don't know how much the people of Great Britain realize how unusual it is and how special it is that one of the two best remote viewers on the entire planet is local to you, is British and lives right there. And so I just want you to know these are the two best remote viewers on the planet, and one lives in Hawaii and the other lives in the UK. You know, it's like, this is a very, very unusual thing. That viewer doesn't live in any other country. So, he's also, Daz Smith, he's also struggling economically. We don't earn a lot. No one gets a lot of money from any of this stuff. So you have a very highly unusual planetary resource that's homegrown and, is one of yours, and I'm not quite sure the people of Britain realize how unusual and how valuable something is that's right in their own backyard. But I just wanted to mention that again.
Well, it says something really about what it is that we value, as a culture, as a species, doesn't it? Because there'll be some people who are interested in your work and sympathetic to what you're trying to do. There'll be others who just have a passing interest in mysteries and in all sorts of unusual phenomena that are mainstream. But in general, we see it today in the general direction the world is headed, that we value material things and those who can deliver them, as it were.
At some point, it has to become an issue of national pride, however, also, because Daz is British and he has done something. He was self-trained, and he has done something that very few people on the planet have ever come anywhere nearly close to. And so that's something to be really proud of. I mean, it's an extraordinary achievement. So Hey, I just sort of put it out there that you guys have gold right on your footsteps. So it's and the other thing is he's a graphic artist and he's really struggling economically because a lot of graphic art stuff is shipped out overseas. So there's not that many people who pay for domestic graphic art stuff anymore. I mean, he's a really good graphic artist for magazines and stuff like that, but it's so easy to get that stuff done outsourcing it someplace else for a couple bucks that it's, you know, very challenging. But on the other hand, the stuff he does with remote viewing in terms of a planetary basis is so much more valuable. He should be one of the richest people on the planet, to be quite honest. But
turning to Daz's session, he's first up in the second part of the new documentary, and as always, it's fascinating to watch these guys literally conveying and relaying the information and as it comes to them, you know, literally on the spot. And he begins to sense this sense of hierarchy amongst the people involved in this, what's clearly a plot. Whoever did what, this is clearly a plot, a conspiracy.
Yeah.
He senses the tension that's in there and the fact that something dark and sinister is afoot. And that's from the off. It's very, very clear. And also something political. And those are the things he picks up on very strongly. And you can see he's quite moved by this. So clearly there was strong energy along these lines in the perceptions that he was receiving.
Yeah, absolutely. He very clearly described a conspiracy of a very high level, governmental, and there was a desire to, there were two groups of people, and one of the groups was highbrow, and the other groups were more lowbrow. Now, they all wore jackets or suits and things like that, but the people who were lowbrow were less comfortable with those suits, with the jackets. The people were highbrow, that's their skin, that's what they wear normally, and they were very okay with that. And the two groups were tense in meeting, because they're normally adversaries. They're normally not, they normally don't meet. And this time they had to meet and they had to make an agreement for exactly how this was going to be done. The handshake had to be done. And so this was not the meeting where the decision was made to kill Kennedy. This was the meeting where the organization was operationalized, where the highbrow people who were connected to the people at the top met the lowbrow people and organized the assassination, how it would be physically carried out and done. This is the handshake meeting. And that's exactly what the target was supposed to be, and that's exactly what Daz did. He saw, and you know, if you watch it, there can be no ambiguity about what they're doing. These are not vague, foggy, fuzzy psychic readings that could be interpreted a zillion ways. These are done under totally blind conditions, and it's absolutely straight up unambiguous of what Daz is describing. So, yeah, there was the two groups, and there was a class difference between them. Now, the lowbrow people were clearly people that is described as people who were handling physical stuff. They dealt with stuff on the street. They knew how to do this type of stuff. And, you know, they were very comfortable on an operational basis. The highbrow people didn't get their hands dirty with stuff like that. And they were very, very much aware that they had to have the lowbrow people to get it done. They were also concerned that there is a separation between them such that there would never be a connection made that would trace it back to the highbrow people. So firewalls were being put up. That was a word that Dick Allgaier put it into one of his sessions. They were very concerned about establishing multiple layers of firewalls to make sure that the people didn't trace this stuff back to the U.S. governmental components.
Now, it's interesting that when you think about assassinations of high-profile figures, presidents or otherwise, whether it's in real life around the world over the decades, or whether it's in fiction, which you know quite often is loosely adapted fact, the classical structure is Secret Service, on its own, perhaps acting in, you know, some sort of black operations outfits, or maybe it's the military, maybe, you know, in the terms of a military coup, or maybe in some circumstances it's elements of the two working together. But of course, one wrinkle that comes up in the Kennedy story is that of organized crime, which he'd been clamping down on heavily. And it then gets to the idea you mentioned about the two groups here involved being ordinarily adversarial. You know, would it be possible even to imagine elements of Secret Service coming together with elements of organized crime to get this done?
Yeah, but it really looks, if I was to speculate now in the role of the Secret Service, it would be that probably at most they were given instructions, perhaps that they didn't even fully understand, to pull back a little bit in certain areas to sort of let this thing happen, but they may not have understood what was going to happen. Meaning, you don't have to have direct Secret Service involvement in the killing. You can have just a little bit of pullback so that they don't get involved, so that there's just, you know, so it happens by itself. On the other hand, what we do seem to get is the people who did the actual shooting seem to be a combat. If I was to just looking at the data and I was to describe who they were, I'd say they looked like they had past U.S. military type training, but they were no longer working for the U.S. military. That they might have had organized crime connections, that they clearly were a rogue unit or a unit that had an organized crime orientation, but that they had a past that involved very highly skilled killing capabilities. And so you take that and mix it with the organized crime, and what you have is the beginning of a good solid firewall. So if the idea was to portray Lee Harvey Oswald as the actual killer, if that were to fall apart, then the next level would be for it to be thrown into organized crime. And that's Lee Harvey Oswald is one firewall. The organized crime orientation is another firewall. There were probably a number of other firewalls that were sort of built in to make sure people didn't trace this back to the law enforcement component of the United States government. But that seems to be what happened from the remote viewing perspective, that that the law enforcement component of the government was brought in, or the federal government was brought in to sort of organize this through proxies.
You could imagine then, in terms of other competing motivations, because what you're describing on one level in terms of getting it done sounds almost like mercenaries on one level. So you could imagine competing motivations along the lines of pragmatism from that point of view, a kind of like it's a job, through to the ideological, you know, perhaps people who had against what Kennedy stood for or what he was trying to do.
That would address the motivations for why Kennedy would have been shot in the first place. However, we have no evidence that this shooting was a result of political, ideological reasons, such as communism. We don't have any evidence that this was a plot. There's no evidence that we have that suggests this was a plot that came out of Cuba or the former Soviet Union or communism or anything like that. So the only evidence that all of these remote viewing data, all of them point to a U.S. government conspiracy that had proxies execute the plan. That's what everything is done. And how they actually did that, it looks like the people who were involved, the proxies themselves, were in fact American. So it doesn't look like there was any foreign involvement. And it doesn't seem to be any ideological involvement, such as a belief in a political system like communism or anything like that.
So the direction this is pointing in is pragmatic, practical, for reasons of power play, things like that, control, money and finances,
Yeah, we'll cover, if you give me time later, we'll cover some of the motivations that would lead you good answers for that. But I want to say right now, yes, the answer to your thing is yes. It looks like they are people who made decisions that Kennedy was an obstacle or a threat to their own understanding of the political system, and that they wanted him gone.
Okay, yeah, well, absolutely. We'll deal with that towards the end of the interview. Turning to Dick's part of the documentary, his sessions, he's always interesting to watch. I love the contrast between the two of them, you know, how they do things similarly and how they do things differently. And Dick often dives in with sounds and smells.
Yeah.
And, you know, Daz is very often picks up on energy in terms of feelings and emotions. And of course, both of them cover all of that, but, Dick seems to be very much emblematic of that Gestalt view. I mentioned this in part one, where you dive into a scene. He says it himself, like just being in a movie theater with your eyes and ears covered, and then suddenly you just open them for a couple of seconds, and bam, there it is. And then you close off your senses again and go, okay, now what was going on there? You know, so it's fascinating to watch him try and figure it out.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he does, both of them focus a lot on visuals, and Dick is particularly talented as, surprisingly so, because he was a journalist for 38 years. He was the face of the news. He was a celebrity journalist, television journalist, 38 years in Hawaii. And he's surprisingly very talented as a sketch artist. So he actually draws pretty well in terms of his remote viewing data. So he gives us really good sketches. And so the perceptions that he often gets are visual, but he also goes after smells and sounds, and like you mentioned, but his visuals, he really looks for good visuals that he can make a sketch out of, and then he spends a lot of time getting those visuals exactly right. So in this particular documentary, we show him develop those things, and you know, a remote viewer has to simply describe what he's seeing or she's seeing. The remote viewer doesn't know why they're seeing that. So they just start these sessions and suddenly they're seeing this. And they just have to trust that whatever it is that they're seeing relates to the target in some way. So they just describe whatever it is. They don't know why they're describing that thing. And so one of the ways that Dick describes his perceptions is that he lands at a target at a certain spot, meaning he lands like a fairy. When you're a child, you're told that the good fairy will capture you in the dreams and land you on a enchanted planet, or that the good fairy will fly in through the window and land on the bed and tell you a story, you know. But he sort of talks about it like landing. So he lands at a target where he's at a scene and he sees somebody. So he saw things that both in terms of people on the street that he didn't know why, so he followed these people and ended up in a meeting. And there was this meeting, and he was describing the people in the meeting. And there was an uncanny similarity between the people at the meeting that Dick was describing and the people at the meeting that Daz was describing. So what Dick did is he said, okay, I'm going to take a time out. He turned off the camera and he said, I'm going to take a time out to draw these people. So he turned off the camera, and he spent a long time drawing these people. Then he turned back on the camera, and there you saw him standing next to the dry erase board where he was looking at the people. And he called those people his cast of characters. And he drew those people, and he had a main guy that he called the jowly fellow because he had big jowls underneath his chin. He was older, and he had a certain type of haircut. And then he had that guy's assistant that was sort of doing some of the operational stuff. And then he had somebody else who was sort of rough and ruddy, good sort of the operations type. And they were talking about things. But the guy at the top didn't actually meet the guy who were doing the operation stuff. So it was like the guy at the top had his assistants sort of do that, but the guy at the top was making the decisions. Now, this guy at the top, Dick also followed him and found him in a car. He was being driven in a car. And so he drew a really great picture of the car. Now, it so turns out, and I mentioned this in the documentary, I do it to sort of head off because it was so obvious from the sketch. I mean, it was almost a perfect sketch, an artist's rendition of what J. Edgar Hoover looks like. I mean, I actually, in the documentary, put a picture of J. Edgar Hoover and a picture of the sketch side by side, and they look identical. And then when you see the car that this guy was driving, I also put a picture in the documentary of J. Edgar Hoover's car, and it's a big black Cadillac, and that's what Dick calls it. They're identical. It looks like he was actually tracing it or sketching it from a picture. So, you know, it was clear to me that people were going to make the connection all by themselves that J. Edgar Hoover was the guy at the top. He was the guy that ran the FBI at the time. So I wanted to cut that off and say remote viewing data cannot be used to prove anything. It would be Dick's sketch, however closely it looks like J. Edgar Hoover, would be equivalent to a police sketch. Now, a police sketch never goes to court. It's never used as evidence. A police sketch is simply given to the detectives and said, whoever did it looks like that. Now, the police detectives then look at that sketch, and that gives them ideas of who to go after. But it's not proof by itself. So that's what Dick's sketch is like. It's not proof that J. Edgar Hoover was the guy, but it gives them indications of the whoever the person is sort of looks like that. So it could have been another person who looked like J. Edgar Hoover and who drove around a car just like J. Edgar Hoover's. And also, Dick mentioned that that guy was afraid of the Attorney General, who happened to be Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy's brother. So it could have been someone who looked like J. Edgar Hoover, drove a car like J. Edgar Hoover, and who was afraid of the Attorney General, and who had jowls, so like that. Now, that may seem like an awful lot of coincidences, but, you know, you have to understand that we can't say that these data prove anything. But it is very intriguing, and, you know, if I were a police detective, and knowing what I do about remote viewing, I would use this as suggestive that might be something I want to investigate. So then I would go investigate sort of physical evidence that might lead in the same direction. But I would use it as a lead, not as an indication of proof by any chance. Remote viewing data, again, cannot be used in a court of law because they've not been accepted yet as real by mainstream science. And no evidence really can prove anything. All it can do is build a case. But it's a very intriguing, and for some people, it may be a very persuasive set of leads that do seem to support the idea that U.S. government official involvement was involved. Now, the other thing is, involved with the killing, the other thing is, with regard to the FBI, if someone in the government had made a decision to kill a president, would it make sense to have the FBI involved in it? And in a logical way, it really would make sense, because if someone in the government had conspired to kill a president and they did not involve the FBI in the actual planning, operations, and so on, then the FBI would have been caught by surprise by it, and they would have launched a full investigation into it, and they most certainly would have caught whoever the culprits were and handed them over to the Justice Department for trial. So if you were actually a member of the government and you wanted to prevent the law enforcement side, which would have been the FBI, from finding out who did it and, you know, handing them over to the Justice Department for trial, then you would have had to have involved the FBI or the law enforcement component in the assassination itself. You couldn't have excluded them and expected to have remained uncaught. So that's from a logical perspective, it also sort of makes sense that J. Edgar Hoover might have been involved in this overall thing. The other thing is that J. Edgar Hoover had a long history of being very cavalier with individual rights and freedoms, and frequently breaking laws with respect to his pet grievances. For example, it is no longer in dispute how he chased and ordered the discreditation and every possible thing imaginable of Martin Luther King Jr. He had, it's now without dispute that he had organized multiple attempts to discredit Martin Luther King, to frighten Martin Luther King, to pursue Martin Luther King, to have him accused. And so, you know, the FBI is, the FBI back in those days under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover was an operation that, fought with their fists. I mean, they didn't hold anything back. It was a different type of FBI than what you have today. So, you know, if you think about the killing of a president, given the way the FBI was run at the time, it's probably within the realm of possibility, given the nature of the person, the organization at the time, and the sort of need to have them involved if it was going to be done in the first place.
Well, how thorough an investigation is does tell us something, and you're alluding to this. For example, if you look at the amount of money spent on the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky affair versus mm-hmm. the 9/11 commission report.
Exactly.
You can see a big difference there. And the 9/11 thing was very much a lot of people have said about the security forces and Secret Service and what have you, elements of that, you know, sort of stepping back a little bit or being misdirected somewhat.
A lot more than a little bit.
Yeah, I was just being conservative, you know. So if you then apply this line of thought to the JFK situation, and you look at, yeah, there was more than one investigation into the circumstances, but relatively brief, wasn't it? You know, and the conclusion was very simple, straightforward, stamped, signed, sealed, and delivered. There's the explanation. We'll say no more about it.
That's exactly how the JFK thing was handled. With regard to the 9/11 thing, normally when you have any type of a crime scene like that, there is a long period of forensic evidence gathering where the evidence on the ground, which would have been the ruins of the 9/11, would have been thoroughly gone into, all the pieces examined and stuff. None of that occurred. The building, the garbage was just simply picked up as quickly as possible. Within a few weeks, it was all gone and disposed of, so that forensic stuff could not be done. With respect to Kennedy, it was a blink of an eye. In fact, when Kennedy was assassinated, the whole backstory on Lee Harvey Oswald was available immediately. Like, how could they have gotten it immediately? Like, how did they know everything of what to say about him within, you know, just within less than an hour of it happening? I mean, it was like, boom, there it was, like, ready to go. Now, with regard to the Monica Lewinsky stuff of the Clinton administration, that actually did not start as a Monica Lewinsky thing. That started as a Whitewater investigation of something that was in the state of Arkansas when President Clinton was then Governor Clinton. And with the sufficient motivation, they kept that thing going for years. And they never came up with anything solid on it. They just kept on. It was their frustration at not being able to get anything solid on it that they, Ken Starr, the lead prosecutor and all that, the independent prosecutor, he was the one who, led that direction and that investigation into a completely different realm. Which is the love affair, the extramarital love affairs of President Clinton, which had nothing to do with his original mandate. Unfortunately, President Clinton, came into the special prosecutor realm after the Watergate situation with President President Nixon. And so he felt that it wouldn't have been politically palatable to fire Special Prosecutor Starr, even though there was really just good justification to argue that he had gone beyond his mandate and was on a political witch hunt. And so President Clinton couldn't really do that, because of they would have raised holy hell that, you know, he was trying to avoid, being found guilty of whatever. So he had to let it just follow its course until dragged out his dirty laundry, so to speak, with respect to the romantic involvements with Monica Lewinsky. So you see, when they want to go after somebody, there's no holding back. And that's what happened with Martin Luther King, and that's what happened with Bill Clinton. When well-placed sources within the government have a motive, they use that motive and they don't shrink from it. But on the other hand, when you see major events such as the assassination of John F. Kennedy or the 9/11 stuff disappearing, all the forensic stuff disappearing within the blink of an eye, then you know that that also is part of the overall story. It all boils down to the manipulation of the masses for political reasons that has become part of our process of governance. Meaning we govern ourselves through secrecy. Now, it's actually part of the official process of governance. And that's what remote viewing really offers as a future to end that method of governance so that we can live in a state of freedom that's different from anything that we've experienced of late. Anyway, that's a good point, Greg.
Well, now is the time then to expand upon the motivations for getting rid of Kennedy.
Yeah, you see, let's go through some of the things that happened. As soon as Kennedy became president, there was the Bay of Pigs incident. That was where a large number of Cuban exiles were organized by the CIA. Now, none of this is in dispute. This is historical record. They were organized by the CIA, and they were launched in an invasion of Cuba that was to land in the Bay of Pigs. And that invasion was to be immediately followed up with U.S. air and naval support. And the argument that was told to Kennedy, this was organized during the Eisenhower administration. So Kennedy came into power and sort of had it thrown on his lap. The argument that was given to him was that the Cuban people were ready to rise up, and all they needed was a spark and a little support from the outside, and Castro would be overthrown. Well, after it had been actually launched, but before the Cuban expatriates had actually landed, Kennedy finally decided, this is crazy. This isn't going to work. We're going to be fought in a huge war, and there's going to be no popular uprising. So he pulled the U.S. forces back, and the expatriates landed. I mean, the former expatriate Cubans landed. They were all shot or arrested. And so that was a huge international embarrassment and fiasco that was squarely put at the foot of the CIA. So they were the CIA had a real grudge against Kennedy. They thought it could have worked. It was stupid. It would never have worked. Kennedy was correct to have pulled it back. But the CIA was really ticked off. So in terms of motivation, that's number one. There was also a good indication that Kennedy wanted to restructure the CIA. So for an institutional reason, the CIA may have felt threatened itself. There was also an indication that JFK did feel threatened by J. Edgar Hoover, and at some point wanted J. Edgar Hoover to go. J. Edgar Hoover apparently fought back and said, basically, you're not going to be able to do that. So the Kennedys apparently didn't push that agenda, but J. Edgar Hoover probably knew that he had an adversary in the White House. Okay. So there was the Bay of Pigs. Now let's also throw in the Cuban Missile Crisis, where there was a 3-day period where we almost all died from nuclear war, where a standoff between the Soviets and the United States forces all focused on nuclear weapons being placed in Cuba was at stake. And then we had a really, really nasty confrontation between Castro and Kennedy in a meeting they had. And then we had documented at least 8 attempts to assassinate Castro by the Kennedy administration. So Castro himself might have had a motivation, and it seemed to be, he said, well, one of these attempts is going to work if I don't kill Kennedy first. So there was a motivation from Castro's point of view. On organized crime, Bobby Kennedy had made a major impact and going after organized crime. So organized criminals were not so happy with the Kennedy administration either. So you have those type of things. And then you also have major pronouncements being done by the Kennedy administration, any one of which would have been more than enough for an entire 8 years with all the stuff that happened in a 2.5-year period, such as, we're going to land a man on the moon before the end of the decade, like in 8 years or bust. I mean, that was a big thing just to say that. And we ended up doing it, but that was a big thing. So there were filled, there was a, the government was filled with very conservative people at the highest levels who might have said Kennedy is too much of a risk. They might have also been influenced by the fact that Kennedy was on a lot of pain medication because of his back, and that he apparently had multiple marital, multiple extramarital affairs in the White House, and there was some indication he might have been smoking marijuana also at some points. So, you know, some of these very conservative elements within the government could just have concluded among themselves that Kennedy had to go. He's a security risk. I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that they would have very likely, back in those days, that those conservative elements would have been thinking like that. And they would have then said he's not going to lose re-election because he's enormously popular. And, you know, and this is all that happened within a 2.5 year period. So they might have just said this has to go. Now, motive, you know, prime motive people, there's a lot of them, but we have no evidence from the remote viewing component that Castro was involved or that the Soviet Union was involved. However, it's possible that the highest level of the CIA and the highest level of the FBI might have colluded and convinced themselves they had a mutual benefit for Kennedy being removed. It's possible that that would fit what we see with these remote viewing data if it happened. Now, I'm not saying that happened. I'm just saying that if that did happen, that scenario would fit these remote viewing data like a glove. And so that's where the motivations sort of come in. And those motivations fit very nicely with what we see on the ground with these remote viewing data. You know, I'm not saying that those are true. I'm not arguing that that's proof. But I'm saying for those people who do understand remote viewing and understand the nature and the quality of these remote viewing data and the skill and the care in which they were collected, that does seem like a very plausible scenario.
Well, one thing that all of this tends to corroborate is the idea that's been growing really since the days of the JFK killing, and that is that the real control in government lies above and beyond the presidency, and that it is to some degree permanent. People may come and go, but that structure itself is there all the time.
Yeah, presidents, politicians are like mayflies. They come and go. The real control are with people who you don't see, you don't know, they're behind the scenes, they're enormously powerful, and they have access to guns, they have access to military elements or sanctions or the ability to kill, and that, or actually to kill or discredit. So you can actually look at Bill Clinton and Bobby and Ted Kennedy, and John Kennedy is very similar in that regard, with the emphasis being a change in strategy. With regard to John F. Kennedy, the decision was made to physically eliminate the person. With regard to Bill Clinton, the decision was made to discredit him. So the current way of thinking among these sort of powers that be seems to have changed. So we have a shift now from the old days in which people were physically eliminated to what's more common now, which is discreditation. That seems to be the way that it's the most likely thing to happen. I mean, if you look at people who were assassinated, the assassination elements that brought other people to power really happened a lot in the 50s and the 60s and really sort of ended around the 70s. And after that, from the 80s on, there seems to have been very little in the form of physical assassination, but much more in the realm of discreditation. It seems like there was a shift in strategy that became somewhat permanent. Well, you get the same effect as killing somebody, but you don't run the risk of having endless investigations, conspiracy theories, constant argumentation, and you don't get people pointing back to the authorities. So when you discredit someone, you don't have the masses pointing back to the people who might have done the job. For example, with Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky stuff, it really ended with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. You don't have people pointing at movers and shakers behind the scenes who might have been organizing the thing. With the Kennedy administration, you get nonstop investigations into people who had been organizing the thing. So, you know, discreditation is sort of a safer way to get rid of somebody than physical killing.
When you look at the fact that the Kennedy motorcade on the fateful day was being filmed, it's perhaps not surprising because it's the president after all, and the news companies are going to want, broadcasters are going to want some footage to show people. Uh-huh. You look at 9/11 and the profusion of recording devices that were around then. Can you imagine the Kennedy scenario playing out now? I mean, look at something like the Boston bombings. Look at these various other public atrocities that have happened since, you know, whether multiple killings or single assassinations.
Yeah.
The internet, within hours of an event like that happening now, I think the Paris attacks recently, is full of recordings and witness accounts. So that makes it very problematic for someone to, now it's one thing for a genuine, for example, terrorist attack to go forward. They're going to do that anyway. They don't care who's watching or who's filming. But if you're going to pull some kind of cloak and dagger act where you want the public to believe something other than what actually happened, you've got a big problem on your hands because you're going to have an internet awash with all of that information within hours.
Yeah, it's not just the availability of cameras. There is that. Oh, that is the technological innovation that made it possible. But you also have a huge planetary population that is suspicious of the authorities. And that didn't occur, that didn't exist back in the days of, back in the 1960s. Back in the 1960s, it was just beginning to happen with the growth of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War. That was when people started to really question the authorities. But, you know, before that, it was people sort of really didn't question the authorities. So the idea of killing somebody back in those days was something that the authorities would likely have said, we can get away with it. But now, it's not just the availability of cameras. What you're saying is absolutely correct. The internet and the availability of cameras. But you throw into the mix a very highly suspicious population where they are so eager to get the cameras and the cameras out, to get the pictures taken, and then to have everything posted online because they saw it. So it's a combination of the technological innovation and a very disbelieving public with respect to mainstream or official governmental pronouncements that makes it almost impossible for, you know, authorities who want to dispose of someone physically to get away with it so easily as they could have in the past.
Well, it's interesting that I don't know what the exact percentages are, but apparently a majority of Americans currently don't believe it partly or entirely the official narrative about the JFK assassination. And
there's a lot of disbelievers, totally, on all sorts of things. They don't believe the official narrative with respect to JFK, with regard to extraterrestrials, UFOs. And there's a huge population, and it's growing, that don't believe the narrative with respect to 9/11. So, I mean, these things simply would not have occurred back in the 1950s and 60s. In the late 60s, you would have had the possibility of that, but it was just beginning. I mean, it was 1968 that the real disbelief and the kickback against the Vietnam War started in earnest. It really wasn't until now that the whole social and political environment on terms of the masses changed so thoroughly, combined with the technological stuff.
Well, the term conspiracy theorist appears to have been developed around the JFK assassination in order to discredit people who were questioning the official scenario. Yes. And of course, since then, this has become an established thing in itself, whether you talk about black helicopters or tinfoil hats. And the issue we have now is that it has been used ever since, and increasingly so, to muddy the waters. 9/11 is the classic example, because anybody who legitimately questions any aspect of that is immediately put in with people who are saying outlandish things like, well, actually there were no planes, or it was a beam that came from space, or whatever it happens to be. And that's a very deliberate tactic. Now, of course, there are people out there who just have theories that are beyond appeal, but the spectrum of questioning from outlandish through to completely legitimate is put into one box of crazy stuff as far as the mainstream is concerned, even if the number of people who question official narratives is greater than those who outright accept it. It's like the official story will march on no matter how many people actually put their hands up and say, wait a minute, and I wonder what it would take to change that. For example, will any alternate version of the JFK events ever be accepted? Will the 9/11 official narrative ever actually be thrown out and say, well, actually, that's not how it happened? And if it did, would it matter? I sometimes wonder, because you have a whole generation now who've grown up in the wake of 9/11, albeit they're still young people. So somewhere down the line, you know, if it gets changed, what would have been a momentous event, a world-shaking event, and should be, i.e. the official JFK, 9/11, whatever it happens to be, moon landings, aliens, any of these stories that actually turn out to be, you know, the mainstream narrative does not work, would people actually shrug their shoulders and go, well, it doesn't, you know, back to work?
Yeah. It's a good question. What would it take? What would it take? Greg, I ask myself that question every single day. What would it take? And I don't know the answer to that. I think that it would take something more than just people like us working at Farsight to publish data and have the data itself change everything. However, I think that we're a component of a larger package that would be required in order to make that shift. So Farsight has to do its stuff. We have to publish our work. But at some point, an outside extra ingredient is going to be necessary to have the planet make a shift away from the governance of secrecy to really a more full embrace of freedom. And that outside element, I don't know where it would come from. It might be required to come from a combination of things, including a brave group of well-respected people on this planet making a statement. I mean, imagine what would happen, Greg, if a well-respected group, I'm not saying this particular group, but let's just, for example, say this, and I'm not predicting this group to do anything like that, but let's just say the Nobel Prize Committee made a statement about remote viewing, that it's real, and maybe a corollary to that, saying people should also more fully discuss the question of UFOs, extraterrestrials, something like that. I mean, if that came out from a Nobel committee, that would change everything. Suddenly there'd be a huge interest in remote viewing, but it would also happen at a time when all of these projects have already come out. So it's not like it would be a statement of remote viewing, but no one's really done anything. But a statement dealing with remote viewing combined with all of these projects all simultaneously happen, that means that when people look in the direction of remote viewing, they'd have stuff to look at. So they'd have like documentaries to go through one after the other after the other. So that would be something that could really change things. In addition to something domestically happening, and I mean domestically on planet Earth, we might be in a situation where the full transformation would require some activity off-world, some extraterrestrial activity to sort of kick the population into sort of a accepting that the ETs are real. Because right now the ETs can do anything they want, and any story will be used to disregard it. For example, the Phoenix Lights, that extraterrestrial ship was seen over five states, potentially by hundreds of thousands of people, and over Phoenix for over an hour and a half by everyone, you know, tens of thousands of people over Phoenix, and witnessed by the governor of the state. So, Governor Fife Symington. So, you know, that was absolutely unambiguous. And the government, 6 months after the event, sent out a lone flight lieutenant who simply said on a press briefing, oh, that was simply some flares we dropped. I mean, it was ludicrous because flares don't hang up in the air for an hour and a half. They don't fly in formation over five states. I mean, and also the governor himself and everybody that was there said, you know, it was so low to the ground that the entire ship blocked out the sky above. And the governor himself said flares don't hang out there. They drop down and they don't fly in formation. And he was a pilot, a military pilot. And he said he knows everything that flies. And that thing was bigger than anything he's ever seen in the air. So, I mean, the idea of just saying it was flares that they dropped, it was laughable. It was like saying it was swamp gas. But the mainstream media reported it just like that and said, ah, they basically ignored the Phoenix lights for 6 months. But when the flight lieutenant made a statement, they published that like, whoa, that was big news. That's been resolved. So, if you're going to get some movement to change the population in a useful way, you're probably going to need something on the level of humans, some important group saying, hey guys, might as well take a look at this, it's real, combined with something off-world happening at the same time, meaning the ET is also kicking it. So you're probably going to get you're going to need that combination of events to do it. And then you'll see a rearrangement of everything. But but Farsight will be an important, crucial component of all of that because the information has to be available to the people when it happens. You can't start collecting remote viewing data at that point. The projects and everything have to be done beforehand. So, that sort of answers the question of what it would take. That's my best guess on what it would take.
Well, just one final thought, Courtney. It seems to me, and a lot of others, yourself included, no doubt, that at the minute and with gathering pace, that the boundaries between the material and the non-material in our world, between mind and matter, mind and body, are kind of beginning to become indistinct, or beginning to dissolve in a way, and that those holding the hardcore materialist line, whether they're spooks or whether they're scientists, whatever it happens to be, are kind of fighting a losing battle. It doesn't look that way from the outside a lot of the time, but I think that you and I and others have this sense that that is the case, that this things are moving and changing. And it may be at a glacial pace, but it is picking up. And I don't know how much change in collective consciousness and understanding we'll see in our lifetimes, but ultimately it's bigger than that. We can just hope to keep things moving and keep awareness growing.
Actually, you're raising a very good point, and it really points to the value of your efforts as a broadcaster. These things are not discussed in the mainstream news at all. So what you do and what other broadcasters like you do is a crucial, essential element in the overall picture. It is the thing that will help move the population to the point where those other things we talked about become possible. Without your efforts, those other points, those other things, and the efforts of others like you, those other things simply would not be possible. So, this interview is one step along that path.
Courtney, today we've been talking about the second part of the latest Farsight documentary, which is entitled The JFK Assassination Part 2. It's been called The Organizers. That's available at your website. I'm not sure if both parts are out on DVD yet, but tell folks about that. Give them the website address and anything else you'd like to share.
Sure, it's www.farsight.org, like seeingfar.org. And the Farsight Institute has a great many projects that it's done. You just go to the website and you'll see them all. But there's one thing I would like everyone to do first and foremost, before you look at anything else, is to sign up for our free newsletter. So it's on the navigation bar. We don't give the addresses, the email addresses out to anyone, so there's no risk of spam. We have an email newsletter that goes out approximately once a week. We're a nonprofit, so we have no means of advertising. So it's the only way we can tell people what we're doing and what the latest projects are. So if you want to keep in contact with who we are and what we do, that free email newsletter is the place to go. So the JFK assassination, it's a remote viewing documentary, and you can see it immediately, like right now, as a video on demand from Vimeo, very high quality. That's the way most people get it. Or if you like to use DVDs, it's available as a DVD, sold through Amazon. So, but all of those links are gotten to just by going to our website, farsight.org.
Splendid. Well, Courtney, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's my pleasure, Greg. And again, you're a great host, and it's a great honor to be interviewed by you. So thank you.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.